Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to the A24 Project here on the Nerd Party Network, where every 2 weeks we look at the filmography of A24, two films at a time. And joining me as ever on that journey through the A24 filmography is Dallas King. How are you?
I'm very well this week and looking forward to talking about up-to-the-minute news, unlike last week when we basically missed everything by about 24 hours. Damn you, A24 and your publicity department.
Exactly. This is just the jinx of this show. So I suppose there's, you know, only one way to kind of officially start off with, and that is, like, as you mentioned, sort of after we had finished recording, I think it was like a couple weeks ago for our last episode, we had chatted about the Midsommar's director's cut. We mused, what could this mean? What kind of release is this going to have, if at all? And then naturally the news broke. So it's continued to sort of evolve over that time about the Midsommar's director's cut. So it is coming out, and by the time this episode drops, it'll be one day away from release digitally in the USA. And there was uproar that it looked like it was going to be an Apple TV only exclusive, basically an HD download extra. When you kind of got the Blu-ray, you could get it on Apple TV, or if you kind of purchased it digitally, you would get that as a bonus as well. And then after days of people writing think pieces and what does this mean for a future digital release, people complaining and arguing and pulling hairs, A24 said in typically cryptic fashion that something special was in the works for the director's cut, and it wouldn't just be an Apple TV cut. So there's a lot kind of going on with this director's cut, and all we know for sure is that we will have access to it in a few weeks' time. Well, if we kind of go by record schedule, we'll have access to it tomorrow. So, Dallas, what do you make of all this Midsommar's director's cut and you?
Oh, it's a Midsommar's night dream for people who like to do film articles and film blogs on one particular topic, but do it about four different times. And yeah, now that I also have an Apple TV, thanks to yourself, I've set it up with an account, so I will be able to download it from America, and I think I probably will. People on this podcast and on Filibuster will know that I am very much an advocate for physical media releases. I like to own the things and actually have them in front of me, because you never know when something might just get deleted off a system and suddenly you don't actually own it anymore. But, you know, I will probably still buy Midsommar when it gets a UK Blu-ray release. Of course, that Blu-ray DVD discussion is a whole another matter. I expect it will probably get a UK Blu-ray release. But I will be downloading it from America just so I can finally get to see it, because we, as it was mentioned, the UK, it was on at Picture House Central a couple of weeks ago as of when this is released, and I think a few people managed to go and see it, but us being up in the heights of dizzy heights of Scotland, it was making it very difficult for anyone other than the Londonites to be able to go see it. And so I'm wanting to see it, and I'm going to sit at home, watch it, and see. Apparently, from what I've heard from people, it is a case of just adding a little bit to the sort of backstory of the village and the colony that live there. Much more of Christian being a total dick and basically making it, yes, he's completely deserving of what happens to him. But, I mean, I had said that I would be happy to spend another half hour in that world, and it looks like I will be able to, and I'm going to enjoy it. Will I ever get to see it on Blu-ray? It's looking unlikely, but digital will be fine just to have that. And maybe down the line you might get a sing-along Midsommar director's cut or something like that that we might be able to enjoy in the cinema if the BBFC rating system ever gets sorted out.
I mean, I think that I've also pre-ordered it, so it's ready to automatically download in a few days' time when it kind of is released. But my feeling is that this film, as a sort of in a director's cut form, is not going to come to the UK at all. Any sort of Blu-ray or special feature in the UK has, as we kind of touched on in the previous episode, in sort of that breaking news segment, needs to go through the British Board of Film Classification, and that film has still not, well, that director's cut has still not gone through that format, so it cannot go onto the UK DVD or potentially even be put up, released online as sort of a special features extra. So it might be, as it stands, the American way is the only way to get that film. So it seems quite messy unless Entertainment One want to follow through and actually get it a rating from the BBFC.
Well, there's still a chance it could appear on the Blu-ray, I think, because I think what would have happened is they would have had to go through the BBFC to get it rated for cinemas, and then they would have to also then do it for the home release, because certain things happen. You do need to get it rated for both, and if you're putting it onto video, that's a whole... Basically, you have to get it re-rated because sometimes things change, especially because anything with a 12A, obviously Midsommar is not a 12A, but a 12A film has to be rated 12 normally for home release, so it does go through a re-rating process. So maybe they were just not going to want to pay it twice, and you never know, we might get a double bonus Blu-ray box set. But as far as I'm aware, I haven't seen a proper release date for it yet, so fingers crossed we may still get something. But I mean, it may be up to, I mean, this is obviously the way that A24 have decided to release it in the US. You know, everyone was talking about this Apple exclusive. As we know, A24 and Apple have worked together for a few years now on projects, so it wasn't really that much of a surprise to me that they may have got an exclusive. Obviously, they're now widening it out, but I think it will be down to, I think it was Entertainment Film in the UK, so depending on how they want to play it, I think it will be, there's still a chance the UK may get it, although it may be rather slim at this point.
I was actually in a position where I could have seen the Midsommar director's cut a few weeks ago, so I was basically given the permission to go see it. So I was down in London to see the Fleabag stage play, and one of our favourite places to enjoy a nice drink, a bit of a chill out in central London, is Picturehouse Central, which is the home of Midsommar. And we were sort of there for a little while. I kind of was making him a joke, like, oh, the film starts in like 50 minutes, we could go see it. And my girlfriend turned around in an act of pure love, went, you have my permission to go see the Midsommar's director's cut. I'm happy to just chill out here. You go see the film. We'll meet up afterwards. That's not a problem. And I went, you know, I'd rather do it together. I feel bad that we've come down for a romantic weekend away in London, and I'm going to ditch you. Not for like 2 hours, you know, which could maybe be all right, but 3 hours plus trailers to watch that director's cut. And I was like, well, if you come with me, I'm happy to go see it. But she was like, nah, it's not my cup of tea. And I just felt that I would have been so uncomfortable, and potentially it could have been used that I was being a bad boyfriend if I had gone and seen that film. And if Midsommar tells us anything, is don't be a bad boyfriend. So even though I had this blessing, I was told it's definitely not going to be a problem, I couldn't follow through up on this absolute open door opportunity to see the Midsommar's director's cut in the cinema. So I have unfortunately had to go, I had to miss that opportunity. I just felt too bad.
You passed the test. I think you definitely passed it. It was clearly a test and you passed it. You will not be burned alive inside a giant bear costume. I might have taken the opportunity. Who knows? it's I do like going to see movies, so yeah, I would have been tempted, but it's a catch 22. You'd be damned if you do and damned if you didn't. So I think you made the right choice. And yeah, I don't think you'll be burned alive anytime soon.
I think I made the right choice, but there's nothing worse than watching a film and knowing that you might be like, oh, is this definitely okay? You need to watch films guilt-free. And I just felt like I would have been like, even though it's definitely okay, you are not going to get in any kind of trouble. I felt like I would have got in trouble.
Yeah, I think the content of the film would just increase your sort of paranoia and guilt to such extremes that I think you probably would have had a mental breakdown as well.
I decided to blame Entertainment One for this situation and not this opportunity that I only had, this one little opportunity, this one window to go see the film. So I found the right people to blame here.
Some would have said it was serendipitous, the fact that you were in London with the opportunity to see it in the first place and giving that up. Ooh, is that the bigger crime? Listeners, let us know. Was Lee right or wrong to skip out on the opportunity? Let us know.
Absolutely. And in news as well, there's really not much we can say at this point because there's no trailer, there's nothing else other than good buzz coming out for Uncut Gems, the latest movie from the Safdie brothers, their follow-up to Good Time, starring Adam Sandler, has premiered in the Toronto International Film Festival at this point, and we don't know much about the film beyond the basic plot. We have no trailer to go on. So far, we don't have any announcement that's even going to make it to London. So, are you excited for this film that we don't really know much about, Dallas?
I am excited for it. Yeah, there's you know, Adam Sandler in the right role can be very good, sort of in a dramatic lead, and I think his sort of manic energy. I think this is apparently a film which uses that for excellent sort of dramatic effect. There will be comedic elements, I think, but all I really know is it's about a sort of a sort of diamond merchant who is in trouble. Because he likes to bet a lot and gamble a lot and loses a lot of money. And then, similar to Good Time, it's just about one day that basically goes from bad to worse. And, you know, Good Time, as we've discussed on this and other podcasts, you know, is one of our favourite A24 films. It's, you know, our favourite Robert Pattinson performance. So if they manage to do that with our Pats, I'm sure that this could be the second coming of Adam Sandler, and it might mean that we no longer have to suffer through his Netflix original films, although the Meyerowitz stories was actually rather good. But the rest of them, such as Murder Mystery, not so much. But fingers crossed, there's an outside chance it could be the surprise film at the London Film Festival. Half of me currently is wanting that, yet half of me wants Parasite as well. I don't know which one I would prefer. I guess it will depend on which one's further away in the release schedule for the UK.
Yeah, I'm torn between. I'm hoping it's going to be Uncut Gems, but not expecting it to. I'm hoping it might be Little Women, but I'm maybe not expecting it to. Parasite feels like the fact that we've got a release date for it, and it kind of feels like it's premiered in everywhere else in the world at this stage, bar the UK, maybe has ruled it out for sort of special kind of surprise film front. It's a tough one to know.
Yeah, Little Women, I mean, Greta Gerwig has got past history as being a surprise film sort of contestant, so there's a chance, but that's a big one to be able to pull off. So I think, well, you know, A24 have history. You know, the surprise film at Glasgow this year was Gloria Bell. Obviously, you know, we're talking about UK releases as if A24 behind them, you know, obviously there's a whole other sort of distribution network over in the UK, but you know, we still consider them A24 films, and with my A24 hat on, I would like Uncut Gems, I think. And I think yeah. There's it's probably, you know, given the betting thing, I'd say it's probably the front runner at the moment to make an appearance, I think.
Yeah, well, I guess we'll find out in a few weeks' time. But in terms of, you know, hearing from people as well, we have another A24 interview coming next week, and it's an absolute really special one, and it's going to be about a 70-minute long discussion with Chris Burjock about the Florida Project, and he's the co-writer of it. He's long-term worker with Sean Baker. So here's a little preview of our upcoming interview. I'd read was that when Sean was looking to get Willem Dafoe involved, he sat down, and Willem, compared to a lot of other people that were maybe interested in the role or you'd spoken to, he just got it in a way that a lot of other people didn't. What was it like to get someone like him involved? Was there a worry that when you think of your other kind of previous work and the rest of the cast, these are all unknowns. Was there a worry that people might look at this and think, oh, that's that bad guy from that movie, or hey, that's that notable face? Was there any sort of worry about that? And what was it about this film that it really struck with Willem so much that he was like, I want to be involved?
Yeah, that's such a great question, you know, Lee, because like it is a concern, and we always write. Like, okay, so for me, like, I was writing the script with the part of Haley with Britney Spears in mind. But we were never going to really, the thought was we would never actually approach Britney to play it. It was just sort of a framework for my mind, the sort of picture. I really need to picture people when I'm writing a script, even if they're not going to play the role, if that makes sense. And so, and plus we thought Britney would be fun because of her Mouseketeer roots, so it would be kind of meta. But the reason why I bring Britney up is because, you know, Sean is the one that's always saying, like, yeah, but we can't, it wouldn't really work for what I'm trying to do with this film to have international, you know, music star slash millionaire Britney Spears playing this homeless woman. He wanted a fresh face. He really wanted a first timer to play Haley. It makes real good sense. And so there's always that concern. And I think Sean had it for Willem, but we're both fans, you know, for a long time with him, and he liked Tangerine. And so Sean's agency set up a meeting. We were in Florida already in pre-production on this movie in the spring of 2016, and we got word that Willem would be willing to meet Sean. And Sean went up to New York just for the weekend, just to meet him, to sort of mention this to him and sort of, you know, gauge his interest. And he was ready, because he just liked, you know, what Sean was all about, the kind of films that he was doing. And Sean explained to him what the process would be like, and working with a lot of first-timers. And I think, you know, from what I remember Sean saying, I didn't go to New York for that meeting, but he was very jazzed at that concept. I mean, it was like sort of a very intriguing concept for him to jump into something like this. And I think Sean sort of felt, in Willem's case, that he's such a guy who could fall into the role and lose, like, you know, that the Willem Dafoe-ness of Willem Dafoe, if that makes sense, and sort of like put the Green Goblin out of everybody's head, which all the kids loved him as, and you know, just fall into the role of Bobby. And it was also great because we originally had the role of Bobby, and Bobby had a right-hand man that we always were writing with, like a Steve Buscemi kind of guy in mind. And what we did was we combined those two roles, because now if you're going to have Willem Dafoe in the movie, you know, you got to give him more to do, right? And so it benefited the script in the sense that it kind of encouraged us to like combine those two roles and give Bobby more weight.
So there we go. There's a little preview as well. So there's a lot of Florida Project chat to look forward to there. And he was absolutely one of the most nicest guests that we could have on. So that's something to look forward to in a couple of weeks' time.
Absolutely. I can say that I've listened to the entire interview and it's fantastic. And especially I love the anecdote towards the end about when the penny drops about the A24 project name as well. It's just fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of these things you take it for granted sometimes. And we'll, after that, in a couple more weeks' time, we've got an interview with an Academy Award winner, Guy in a TV, about Skin. So that's something to look forward to. And I think we might probably touch on that later in this episode, which is pretty awesome. But we've also just recorded an interview literally just before this one dropped. So this one won't be coming out until late October. But we have an interview with Catherine Olivier about her performance as Kennedy, the bully from 8th grade. So we had a wee chat about making of 8th grade. She originally auditioned as well for the role of Kayla as well. Some really fun stories about the making of 8th grade as well. So that's our second ever guest that's been involved in the making of 8th grade to look forward to in a few weeks as well.
Absolutely, but you know, sooner or later we'll have the entire cast on, the entire cast and crew.
Yeah, that's for sure. We'll slowly make our way through it. So in this episode, we're going to look at The Lovers and The Exception. So first up, we have The Lovers. Deborah Winger and Tracy Letts play a long-married, dispassionate couple who are both in the midst of serious affairs. But on the brink of calling it quits, a spark between them suddenly reignites, leading to an impulsive romance. So written and directed by Azazel Jacobs, this was A24's second ever produced film after Moonlight. So to the stage, every other film but Moonlight has been distributed. Now they're sort of moving towards making something of their own content. So Dallas, when was the first time you saw The Lovers?
First time I saw The Lovers was about 2 weeks ago before recording this podcast. It's a first watch for me, and it was an interesting one because I'd never really heard of it before, and it was, so I didn't know much about it and put it on, and I was actually pleasantly surprised by this. It sort of wasn't what I expected, and I sort of really liked the fact that it was a sort of raw, honest, and sort of heartfelt look at a modern day relationship. And basically the central affair is not actually the two affairs that the married couple are having. The affair feels like the relationship that's happening between them. They become so disconnected that, you know, their new relationships seem the norm. They're just sleepwalking through life. And it's this affair between the two of them that sparks off the sort of this film. And yeah, I find it really sort of interesting, and also the fact that it was you know, there's a romance between sort of two older actors, you know, was interesting and an interesting place to watch it from. And yeah, I really enjoyed it. What about yourself?
Yeah, this one was one that really caught me by surprise. It was sort of on my list of A24 films I've never seen, didn't know anything about to check out. And I remembered one weekend, I was just, I think I had the flat to myself, and I was like, you know what, I'm just going to blitz a bunch of movies. And then I remember this one really caught me by surprise in sort of a like really niche A24 way. Like, I was like, oh, The Lovers, it's on Netflix, I'll put that on to watch now. And then when the film opened with the A24 logo, I was like, oh, that's something that we don't really get here in the UK by this point of the filmography, because as we say, A24 distribute nearly all the other movies that they've done, and the rest have either been released maybe by Film 4 or Entertainment One, you name it. So with this, it was kind of like, oh, okay, this is odd that it's an A24 film and it's got the logo in the UK. And that's when I sort of realised they'd had this was a movie they had put the money into. And we sort of know some of the bigger movies that they've perhaps put the money into, you know, your Moonlight, Lady Birds. So that one really kind of caught me by surprise, and I really enjoyed it. It was a, for me, this is the point of sort of maybe doing this podcast, to be honest, is that, you know, we think of all the films that we've kind of discussed kind of in the past and to come, you know, a lot of them are well known or ones that people are familiar with perhaps. This one, I think, kind of flies under the radar for a lot of people. And I think it's a real gem of a film. You know, I think people think of A24 films as being focused on perhaps younger characters, hip, trendy people, people from the coastal elite areas. For this, it was just about older people and romance. And I think we talked about it, and we talked about it in the interview we did with Azazel Jacobs a few months ago. This movie sort of appeals to that grey pound, that getting that older audience in that might see themselves reflected in these characters and not necessarily just turning up to see the same stories about younger people again.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it was refreshing to see, you know, this spin on, because as you say, yeah, the up till this point, I think, yeah, a lot of the A24 films have been very sort of, I hate to use the word hipster led, but you know, they have been definitely aimed at a younger audience. The A24 stands who are always on Twitter, you know, buying the cool t-shirts and stuff like we just done, you know. And it'd be interesting to see what the wider A24 Hive audience think of this film, because it is very different. But I think what appeals to it is the honesty and the writing. If you completely believe these characters, and you know, the when they sort of develop the spark between them, you actually end up rooting for them, even though clearly stuff has happened between them that has led them to drift apart. But you're actually then actively wanting them to get back together, and it then goes down a way that we can discuss in a bit, but I found myself really sort of really rooting for these two to make it work and get back together, I think.
Yeah, I think so as well. And I think now would be a sort of a good little opportunity to give you a little kind of small segment about, you can hear our thoughts on the film, but why don't we hear from the writer-director of the film himself, Azazel Jacobs. So here's a little small a small part of our interview. We had almost a 70-minute long discussion with Azazel about his career, making this film, his involvement with A24, and it was one of my favourite interviews to carry out. So here's a little bit of an extract from that interview, and we'll put the full link to that interview in the show notes as well if you want to check out. So here's Azazel.
Is it challenging as a young man like yourself to get into the mindset of an older couple who have lived through such a long relationship together, or do you draw from your own experiences and those around you?
It was fun, interesting. My way in was definitely the boy, the kind of the ex super sensitive boy, you know, their son, you know, who's played by Tyler Ross. Like, I think that was I remember very much that first feeling of feeling like, oh, you're being lied to by adults. And just what kind of bullshit world this was, and you just wanted to tear it all down. And even though my parents were very honest and very, you know, like and very truthful, that there's that moment as a young person where you realize how much bullshit you're being surrounded by and how infuriating that is. And so I think my way in was through Joel, that character. Through the writing of it, I think going through experiences and relationships, I also understand how relationships are complicated and simple, and how it's kind of I do have a different view on it in terms of judging relationships. And now I think that was the other thing that was going on, is I was watching a few close friends and close relationships break up, and it was very hard for me to go like, okay, so that love didn't exist, it did exist, it's no longer exists, it's just confusing. And so the writing of it came from a place of really kind of watching these characters go than judging them so much, and just seeing what they do and trying to be honest to their path.
At what stage does someone like A24 get involved? Because at this stage of their filmography, they were known for distributing films, not producing films. How did they come to produce your film? You're one of the earliest ones that they produced. How did that come around?
A24 was getting a thing, and they were just going to start financing small films at that point. And so I think we just had heard about Moonlight. I mean, Moonlight hadn't shot yet when we started the conversation with them, and that was the first film up, and we were the second. And what happened is we sent out the script to, a few different people, a few different companies, and the script resonated. Like, and suddenly there was quite a bit of interest. A24 responded very, very fast, very, very positively. They liked my work, and they really appreciated the script. And it just it wound up becoming between another company and them. And the other company offered a lot, many times. Kind of, they started off many times the budget that A24 did, but A24 offered an amazing amount of control with this project that the other company didn't. So it was a really easy choice for me. Like, they took 1 minute when I asked for certain things in terms of having Final Cut, and they said, absolutely, that's yours. That meant so much to me. And that's how that began. And I got to say that, like, even my first conversation with Tracy Letts, when we're talking about him being in the part, in the role, I know that A24 just have, by that point, so I didn't bring on any actors, even though Dip Winger had loved Terry and emailing kind of throughout the years. But I really hadn't brought any actors on when I gave it out to A24 and got them on board. But I do remember that he really responded to the script. And he also was like, you know, it's funny, my wife and I, every time we'd watch a film and that we'd love it, we started realizing that it was the same logo in front of it. And so I know that was the first time that I also got an indication of A24 being a real help besides financing the film. Just they had already kind of created something, you know, a name for themselves that they've only gone stronger in since.
So there you go. So if you want to hear more of that, you can find the link in the show notes for a lot more discussion. So with this, like you were touching on the story goes down a certain way, and I'm hesitant to kind of go into too much spoiler territory, because I'm not too sure how many people have actually kind of seen this film, and I'm hesitant to spoil anything or even give away perhaps some of the ending and discussion points in fear of people kind of having that taken away from them for our listeners.
Yeah, no, I can completely understand that. You know, we did this sort of on the last episode. We were both huge fans of The Black Coat's Daughter, aka February, if you're currently on UK Netflix and want to watch it. And we'd basically found this film first time watch and sort of decided it was a hidden gem, and a lot of stuff happens from the halfway point onwards that we were very keen not to spoil and discuss, because like you say, everyone knows the big hitters, but we're now sort of reaching the point where I guess because A24 have almost so much content, I mean, they seem to be releasing about sort of 12 films a year, that not all of them maybe get the same level of a push in America, or in certainly in the UK, where some don't even really get proper distribution. So sometimes there will be films like this that haven't really sort of managed to break out into the mainstream. So I can understand, yeah, we don't want to go into too much detail as to the ending, but I did think, you know, you could tell that it was leading to something, and it's not a spoiler to say that they keep talking on the phone whenever they're together with their two other partners, played by Aidan Gillen, and I just think it's fantastic to see Melora Walters again on the big screen. She's someone who, you know, if you listen to the episode on 1999 on Filibuster that we talked about, your number one film of that year was Magnolia, and she was just fantastic in that. And she's someone that we haven't really seen as much of as we should have since, so it was nice to see her back in a role like this. And I think that when they're talking to them, they keep talking about the fact that, oh, our son's coming, he's coming back from college, he's coming back from college. After that, you know, it's definitely over, and then we can continue on with our relationship. So we're going to talk to my wife, I'm going to tell her it's over, and that's it. And it's just, I thought it was an interesting twist that all American movies seem to have families disintegrating when they're meant to be coming together on sort of dinners and holidays. You mentioned Krisha, you know, earlier, and this is a film where the same thing happens. You know, people are coming together for dinner, but instead of coming together, basically it fractures them completely. And, you know, arguments happen, you know, secrets are exposed, lies are exposed and stuff like this. And, you know, at least it wasn't set at Thanksgiving, so it didn't have that cliche, but, you know, it's all building to the sort of powder keg, will, you know, the truth come out and stuff like that. So it was really sort of that you could feel a bit of tension sort of building up towards this, what's going to cause the thing to switch. And I did like that. And I mean, it's completely sold by the performances of Deborah Winger, who up until sort of watching this film, I realized that I kept getting her and Barbara Hershey mixed up, because I was sure that she was in Beaches, and no, that turned out to be Barbara Hershey, but she was in Tears of Endearment and Officer and a Gentleman. And then sort of Tracy Letts, you know, Daddy Lady Bird, who'll be coming up in a bit. And fun fact, also the writer of Killer Joe, which features the most creative use of a chicken drumstick in cinema history as well.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's such a great cast, and it's one of these ones that for me, it came up the other day where someone was like, what we need to do is do like, I think it was a critic from Little White Lies did, you know, we should have a bad dad's calendar for A24 characters. And then someone kind of put underneath, oh, but what about a good dad's one for someone like Tracy Letts? And I kind of replied, oh, I was like, well, actually, he's a good dad in Lady Bird, but an absolutely pretty terrible one in The Lovers. And I get the impression that, you know, when people have spoken about, oh my God, Tracy Letts is amazing in Lady Bird, and, you know, and he certainly is. But I think in The Lovers, he's just that little bit, he gets a more fuller role. And I feel that if you're a fan of Lady Bird and you want to see, you know, someone like Tracy Letts in a, you know, he gets the full kind of leading man performance in here, I think this is definitely one to check out.
No, absolutely. I think he's acting wise, he's not someone that I've seen much of other than small roles. It was great to see him in a full leading role like this, and he's definitely, I do want to check out sort of more of his back catalogue, because I think he's got such a great presence. He's very sort of gentle and welcoming, but you can tell he's got an edge to him because he's very adept at sort of lies and deceit and stuff like that. So he's the kind of person who you'd probably be able to see as playing a villain in like a Hollywood sort of action blockbuster, someone who's, you know, meant to be like the good person, but then, you know, twists later on and turns out that he was actually the mastermind behind it all. I think he's got that kind of role in him, I think, and it'd be something that'd be exciting to see, I think, on the big screen in the future.
Yeah, definitely. And one thing I really enjoyed about this film as well was the score by Mandy Hoffman. What did you make of it, Dallas?
Oh, no, yeah, I did like the music. I thought it was really, it sort of helped to sort of build the sort of levels of emotion throughout the film, and also love the use of music and in the film as well. I thought particularly the song you know, this is almost like a running gag about, oh, that you can play the piano, and then sort of when he plays that song at the end, it's just sort of utterly sort of encapsulates the whole sort of mood of the film and how it's going to play out from that point. I thought it was really sort of really, I'm not going to actually say the word because then that would actually give away the potentially the ending, so I'll just say that it was very effective and spot on in its use.
Yeah, definitely. This film kind of got me to having a wee think as well, and I know we touched on it sort of a little while ago when we talked about 20th Century Women, sort of the current state of play with something like Annapurna, where Annapurna have been known for like throwing money at like auteur filmmakers to, you go make whatever the hell you want, blank check basically, and for better or worse that kind of system has led to them sort of to bankruptcy. Basically they're having to pay out and bail out lenders after some underperformances at the cinema. It's got me to sort of thinking about sort of the A24 model just that little bit, where we looked at Moonlight and I think it cost at most maybe $2 million. It wasn't a huge investment and it went on, won the Academy Award. Something like The Lovers, I don't have the budget information available to hand, but I don't think the film was going to cost more than a couple million to make. And again, it'll be a nice return on investment. It did well in the film festival circuit. It's there on Netflix now. It probably puts some money into the coffers every single day. And it makes me sort of think about what's maybe the better model. Is that sort of the Annapurna one, where it's like, you know, here's 30 million, here's to go make a Sister's Brother or a Phantom Thread, etc., like that? Or is it sort of that something that's maybe helped guide A24, where it's that small investment, and you know, certain films have got more money, something like Midsommar for example, but is that sort of model that A24 has kind of adopted the one that's helped keep it sort of above ground in sort of a competitive industry, where films like The Lovers and a lot of the films A24 have released or distributed are competing against big buck movies as well? What's your take on it, Dallas?
It's an interesting one, because, you know, like you say, with the Annapurna situation, looking at my top 10, I've got about 3 Annapurna films on there. So in terms of quality, they always seem to hit it out of the park, but for some reason or another, when it comes to hitting the box office, they just don't seem to be able to translate that quality into cash. And whether that's the marketing potentially comes down to, it's always a very tricky one, depending also time of release and stuff like that. If you're heading into blockbuster season, things could get swallowed up. You know, Midsommar for A24 was clearly programmed as a sort of alternative to Spider-Man when it was released in the US and in the UK. But A24, you know, that they're an interesting and almost sort of unique case, because they do only distribute within the US, obviously. Any then, you know, other rights are then sold on to other companies in other territories such as Europe, Asia, India, etc. So, you know, has to be said that they do seem to be knowing what they're doing in terms of making a small return, you know, on their investments. You know, Moonlight obviously hugely helped by the fact that it got all the Oscar buzz and then Oscar winning. So that probably set them up for being able to take a few riskier chances. So it'd be interesting to see exactly what else they look to produce in the future. But in terms of distribution, I think they've managed to get it right, and that basically almost out of nowhere they seem to have built a brand where, as you say, you know, these films are mostly distribution deals, but when we come to think of these films, we think of them as an A24 film. So they've managed to create a whole brand about it, and if anything, you know, perhaps they almost make more money from their merchandise than their films, as anyone just looks at the price of a t-shirt. And the fact, I mean, technically they could make more if they didn't make it as limited edition and it sells out within, you know, 5 minutes of it going online. They could make an absolute fortune, you know. But I think they'll be able to test the popularity of their films, certainly from the new mugs that they've just released, because they'll get a good idea of which ones the people are going for. Will anyone go for a glimpse into the curious mind of Charlie Swan III? I'm not entirely sure. More probably would go for a Moonlight mug. Yes, I think they will. But I think they've managed to certainly go very well so far in we got The Farewell coming up, so you know they're clearly looking at films which tap into certain areas of the market that are potentially, like you say, with this one, that are neglected, in that this is a romance love story for older generation. So basically they pick and choose their battles. They never, so far as well, I don't think A24 have ever released one that has gone wide market, will appeal to absolutely everyone. They know when to pick and choose their battles, and I think certainly from the evidence so far, they're going to continue doing very well for a very long time, I think. And I think they'll be able to, I think they're going to move into that market eventually that Fox Searchlight potentially had. And because it looks like Disney, certainly from the leaked notes on how people were feeling about Jojo Rabbit, I think they're going to basically slip into that role, steal a lot of talent, and basically become the home for sort of independent, smaller Oscar bait going forward. Leave Disney to the blockbusters and stuff like that, and A24 will clean up with the Oscars, I think.
Yeah, I can't wait to visit A24 world, where God knows what the gift shops will be like in that place, and the theme park rides, you know. It would be that, I suppose that's an interesting thing to think about.
That could be an awesome episode to discuss in the future. You know, the Under the Skin ride, where you all get into a little white transit van and you're going around into sort of black sludge and stuff like that. And then a midsummer sort of interactive ride where you get given a midsummer style medieval times esque dinner. Could you imagine that? I wouldn't eat the pie, but anything else is probably fair game.
Yeah, most definitely. So I think this is one that, it's safe to say, this is a really positive reaction we've had to this film.
Yeah, no, this was a real sort of a genuine delight to find. And, you know, it's a very low-key film, you know, but it's a really sort of powerful drama fueled by fantastic performances all around. If I had any small criticisms, it was maybe that there was maybe not enough time spent with sort of Aidan Gillen's character and Melora Waters. I think those relationships could have been built up slightly more to give you more of a sort of push and pull between which way you wanted the lovers of the title to go. But other than that, I thought it was an excellent film, and it's definitely one that I think people would need to check out if they're wanting to find out more about A24's back catalogue. What about yourself?
Yeah, I'm really positive about this one, and I enjoyed the film going in. My interview with Azazel enhanced it, and it's added more to the film for me to think about as well. So yeah, a really enjoyable film, and makes sort of doing this podcast, it's not just rewatching the classics that we know are going to be great. It's sometimes we've had some negatives along the way, but we found some real gems, and I think this is definitely one of them. And I hope that we can, by covering it, people will definitely check it out.
I hope so, and you know, there may be a few more negatives on the way, you never know.
Yes, which segues perfectly into our next movie. So, the Nazis make their third appearance in the A24 filmography with The Exception. Though there's no Nazi dogs this time, Christopher Plummer returns as a German.
Very disappointed at the lack of Nazi dogs. I was scouring every inch of the frame during this film looking for one.
I know, I was doing the exact same. But Christopher Plummer returns as a German as he plays the exiled Kaiser Wilhelm II. So, a German soldier tries to determine if the Dutch resistance has planted a spy to infiltrate the home of Kaiser Wilhelm in Holland during the onset of World War II, but falls for a young Jewish Dutch woman during the investigation. So, Dallas, was this a first-time watch for you?
This was indeed a first-time watch for me. It was one which I'd actually never heard of before starting the project, and yeah, I think there's probably a reason for that. It was one that I managed to find a copy in my local library, so it did get a release, but it was one that, this one almost more than any other film, I think, doesn't feel like an A24 film to me. It feels like a BBC sort of period historical drama that you would watch on a Sunday night rather than an A24 film. What about yourself?
100% agree. Remember there was that film earlier in the year where it had Keira Knightley, and it was about some sort of German love romance. I can't remember the name of the
Aftermath.
Film, but it was like advertised at yeah, the aftermath, and it was advertised in like train stations. You saw the trailer, but you never actually knew anyone that ever actually went to see that film at all. And it, you watch it and you think, that's a film that I'm pretty sure I've seen like 100 different times in different places. And yeah, like this was a film that I was watching, it was like, you know, yeah, A24 have a type of film that they make. It's, you know, films from a unique point of view. And sometimes those are great films, whether it's something like The Lovers, Lady Bird, Moonlight, you know, whatever. And sometimes it comes up short. And but this film, I was like, oh, right, I don't necessarily get what this brings at all. And I don't really understand why they would invest in distributing this film. I know it kind of was a straight to sort of distribution on sort of DirecTV, but I couldn't really see why they wanted to put any kind of money into this film. And I suppose we now probably judge it by who would buy the mug with this film name on it. I don't know who's going to buy this mug, and I always run it by the old test. I'd sometimes check Letterboxd before I watch an A24 film to see, hey, what's the consensus from my pals on it, just in terms of a star rating. And this one had barely anyone at all had viewed it, if any of my friends, apart from you. That's kind of telling in itself. Usually these films can take up pages, or there's 10 to 15 people. This one had my esteemed co-host.
Yeah, I mean, you said there that, you know, the A24 films look for films that have a unique point of view, and this certainly does have a unique point of view, in that it seemed to suggest, oh, we've reached a stage where films about the Nazis are, well, hey, not all Nazis are bad. This is a good Nazi because, you know, he falls in love with a Jewish Dutch girl and wants to basically make sure she escapes the war because she happens to be, and I'm sorry, I'm going to spoil this film because I don't care. Basically, he gets into the thing, he's like, he's got to search for a spy. There's apparently a spy in the house who's feeding information to the Brits. And it's like, I don't know. I think you could have watched, as long as you've watched any film in the history of cinema, you know exactly who the spy is going to be. Unless you've got like a big name actor in a very small minor role, it's basically going to be exactly who you think it's going to be. And it was no surprise when it actually turned out to be that. And yeah, it was just, this has to be probably one of the most dull and boring films that I've watched on the A24 project. There was just no real sense of urgency. And I mean, I expect it probably would appeal to people who like The Aftermath, or, you know, that kind of historical, like Suite Française and other films. You know, I had a look after watching this film, and yet it's based on a book. You know, people have got slightly alternative takes on history and like putting sort of romances in where there doesn't need to be romance. You know, oh, you know, everyone's done historical, you know, documentary films about and books on World War II. Let's write a nice little romance between a Dutch spy and a Nazi officer. And it's just like, I think what didn't help as well is the casting in this film. Jay Courtney, I'm sorry, but he's just an actor who I just cannot get behind when he's on screen. You know, this is someone who's been in, you know, Terminator Genesis, you know, the Divergent franchise, Good Day to Die Hard, another franchise which he seemed to ruin, Suicide Squad, Alita Battle Angel. You know, he's just a presence on screen that just does not captivate me. And I have to say that Lily James is kind of the same. You know, some people would argue that, you know, a certain website from the early 2000s would say there's probably two good reasons to watch this film. But other than that, then, you know, I'm struggling, to be honest.
Yeah, I one of the Letterboxd reviews that made me chuckle when I saw it was like, Lily James got naked for this. And it's like, it's genuinely a pretty poor movie. But if I was being positive, I think the film does take a bit of a twist towards the end for maybe a 10-15 minute spell, with the appearance of Eddie Marsden as Heinrich Himmler. So Himmler, for those who weren't kind of bamboozled with German and Nazi history in high school, like we are always in Britain and America, Himmler was one of the most powerful men in Nazi Germany and the main architect of the Holocaust. So he swings by for dinner in the sort of the last quarter of the film, and basically setting up Wilhelm to, you know, come back to Germany, but with the intent of finding out who is still loyal to the royal family in Germany and execute them. I found the film somewhat interesting when he made an appearance because it brings a quite a sinister edge that we've had this, as you mentioned, you know, Nazis, here's some of them as kind of good guys and whatever's kind of going on here. Then we have this real piece of shit come along, and I find people's interaction to that, how Wilhelm meets sort of Heinrich Himmler and sort of how far he's willing to sort of indulge his policies to reclaim his throne, I found that somewhat interesting, and I wish that had been the movie as opposed to this sort of predictable love romance.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, the movie just, there's a different movie happening when Eddie Marsan comes on as Himmler. You know, he's an actor who I really rate very highly. You know, he can do sort of sad sex sort of comedy in sort of films like The World's End, and then he can be a real piece of shit, like you say, in Tyrannosaur, Peter Mullen's film. He is just one of the most despicably cruel, evil people ever in that film. So, and he can just flip between the two very, very easily. But yeah, there's a different film sort of taking place when he comes on. He sort of brings the energy up almost, and he sort of brings a bit more out of Christopher Plummer in those scenes as well, who is a great actor, but you know, when he's got great material to work with. And it's just interesting that for the, in terms of A24 films, he always seems to play ones where there's sort of Nazis involved. He seems to be typecast almost at this point.
Yeah, I think so, and hopefully we get him back in again, because you know, he's a fantastic actor, and I really did enjoy his performance in Remember. Here it's sort of like a bit kind of paint by numbers, but as I say, I think that whole sort of dinner party scene kind of raises the film and makes it about something. You know, Germans sort of, you know, always think of is it was Captain America, the first Avenger, I think it's the first time we've quoted Marvel in the A24 project, where it's like, you know, the first people that were conquered by the Germans were the German people. And you know, I totally agree, not all Nazis were despicable or horrible people. Some of them were people that got caught up into things or forced into things, and I think, you know, making it all a black and white thing, you know, probably does it a little bit of a disservice. But I think that is an interesting debate, because it plays out over that dinner table scene. How far are people willing to go to accept the Nazis if they get some benefits out of it? Who's disgusted by it but is in a world of intimidation and fear? I think there's something really interesting going on there. It's just a shame about the rest of the 90 minutes.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's the fact that, you know, you had the chance to say something and explore sort of the, you know, the banality of evil and, you know, when good men do nothing sort of thing by sitting aside. And but it's, yeah, it's just being wrapped up in this sort of awful, sort of cheesy sort of romance around it, that, and then played by two people with very little chemistry, it has to be said. You know, if there was any chemistry between Courtney and James, then perhaps you could have been more invested in it. But unfortunately, yeah, no, I think, you know, I was searching for a way to put in a pun about this is the exception to the rule in terms of quality A24 films, but we have had a few stinkers in the past, so it's certainly not the exception, but it is definitely down near the bottom for me in terms of dull, lifeless missteps on the A24 catalogue so far.
Absolutely, but I suppose we've had a nice mixed bag for this episode, which is really pleasing in a way, because I think we've watched two films for relatively new, or we've come to them for the first time, and one where we're really passionate about, check it out, and another that is like, yeah, maybe skip that one. But based on how difficult this one was to find, you couldn't even rent it from Amazon. I had no choice but spend $1.99 on it for a digital copy that will be forever stored in my Amazon Video thing. I can never get rid of it. It's not like a DVD where I can go, hey, I've watched that, I can give it away. I will literally have the exception in my Amazon cloud for the rest of all the time.
Well, and I'm sure you'll be returning to it every year just to remind yourself how great it is. But you know, this is it's kind of the reason why we're doing the podcast and this project, is, you know, to shine a light on, you know, everyone knows the big names, but shine a light on the other ones. And, you know, you will find films which are not very good, but then, like you say, you know, we will occasionally find unearth a hidden gem like The Black Coat's Daughter or The Lovers. And, you know, if this podcast gets a few people, you know, watching those films, and, you know, hey, everyone is allowed a different opinion. Some people may enjoy the exception. There is maybe some things that people might like about it. So yeah, I mean, if you do watch it and think we're wrong, you know, let us know. You know, tell us what you enjoyed about the exception.
Absolutely. And if you are picking up the exception mug, do let us know. So we'll be back in 2 weeks' time for, we'll be looking at It Comes at Night and a Ghost Story, and we'll have an interview next week with Chris Burgock to kill your time. So thanks everyone for listening. I was sort of thinking about it this week, like there was a, I think they were advertising a new podcast where it's like stars of The Office will watch every single episode, like 200 odd episodes of the Office, and review it, and you know, it gets a lot of attention. And I'm sitting there thinking, like, I'm amazed that we have people that listen to the show, leave us lovely reviews, you know, recommend us on Reddit, these sorts of things. So I'm really thankful to everyone that's left a review, given your time, subscribed, checked out the show. I know there's literally a podcast for everything that it demands your time and interest, so thankfully people keep listening to this show, and hopefully we'll continue to try and do a good job and keep trying to bring you interviews and film discussion. So thanks to everyone for listening. I really do appreciate it, and I'm sure you're the same.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's always nice to read reviews on iTunes and to see that people are, you know, downloading and listening to the podcast and giving us feedback. And we will both be at the London Film Festival checking out The Lighthouse and The Last Batman in San Francisco. So if you are at those screens and you want to hit us up, you know, give and chat to us during the festival, you may even get a sticker. I'm going to take some stickers along the London Film Festival. If anyone mentions us, you know, then I'll try and get you a sticker.
Absolutely. So we'll join you both together again in 2 weeks' time with another bunch of film discussions. So thanks to everyone for listening. Bye.